from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually in our state by 2025. Through increased opportunities for West Virginians to earn the credentials today's economy demands. The High Technology Foundation, building a stronger West Virginia, online at wvhtf.org.
At the legislature today, senators are still awaiting a ruling from the West Virginia Supreme Court on who will replace a member that resigned earlier this month, but they're one step closer today after oral arguments were heard in the case. Right to work is quickly becoming a top priority for members of both chambers despite its controversial nature, and the higher education system in the state is once again facing potential budget cuts that could have some major implications. Those stories coming up on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. The West Virginia Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in the case to replace Senator Daniel Hall in the state Senate. Hall resigned earlier this month. Elected a Democrat in 2012, Hall switched parties in 2014 after the midterm elections to give the GOP a majority in the chamber. But it's because of that switch that state leaders are questioning who should replace him. The state Democratic Party has taken the question to West Virginia's highest court for an answer. Justice Brent Benjamin recused himself from the proceedings today, likely because he's up for re-election this year. Chief Justice Menas Ketchum chose not to appoint a replacement, and four of the five members of the court will make the final decision, which could come by the end of the week. Here are some of the arguments from today's hearing.
One of the points that I'd like to make is to imagine in the abstract a legislature trying to talk about what kind of statute they're going to pass. A legislature that's made up of people who are members of parties. Does anybody really believe that those legislators, after spending all the time and money to get their people elected, are going to intentionally pass a statute that lets the other party poach one of their people and get a seat? I mean, that's what we're talking about here. I mean,
that's what the statute looks like it allows on its face. The statute is fairly clear on its face. It's difficult to see an ambiguity, and I think that one thing that must be recognized is that this is obviously amongst the members of the legislature and members of others groups that have interest in what the legislature does. This has become a political question, but the court has got to approach it in a non-political matter and strictly in a legal matter in interpreting what the statute says, or in moving into a constitutional context, as Justice Davis points out.
And Justice Workman, I think the reason the statute's ambiguous is because, and it's ambiguous, it's not ambiguous most of the time. It's ambiguous because it's applied to these peculiar facts that the legislature didn't consider. And you can really read the statute two ways.
He was affiliated with both parties. He was elected as a Democrat. He ran as a Democrat, the voters elected him, and he served the majority of his term of office as a Democrat. So I would submit that he was affiliated with both parties for purposes of that statute. Where the ambiguity comes into play is an as-applied reading of this statute. And the best way to show that is the Richards case. It has some great language. It says the statute at issue, and that's the, I believe it was the Wyoming statute, does not address or anticipate the situation presented in this case. That's what we have here. Our West Virginia statute doesn't anticipate a party swap. Because of that fact, we've got to look at the point of the statute. And the point of the statute is to honor the mandate of the voters.
The legislature in 1963, when it included that language immediately preceding the vacancy, did take into account the possibility that there could possibly be a change in party affiliation. by the very nature that they didn't leave it silent. They did identify there's a specific point in time that the governor must look at with respect to the vacating legislators' party affiliation immediately preceding.
Well, I'm going to go back right back to Rodriguez again, because the Rodriguez court held that there was no unequal treatment because the interim appointment applies uniformly to all legislative vacancies whenever they arise. In your situation, the way the statute is written requires different results at different times when the vacancy arises. So you tell me how that meets the constitutional requirement set out in Rodriguez.
Again, Your Honor, I think it focuses on the fact that we, the citizens of West Virginia, in this instance specifically citizens in the 9th District, elected a person and not a party. And again, wasn't based solely on a party designee. People from various different political parties could have voted for Senator Hall. And they put their trust in him to make the decisions and make votes. He's not required to vote along the party lines in every vote that he faced within the West Virginia Senate. And part of that decision to best represent his constituents included his constitutional right to change party affiliation in order to best represent.
Nobody's debating that. He has the absolute right to do that.
There's a group of voters who, we don't dispute this, probably voted for Daniel Hall because he had a D next to his name in 2012. However, there is also a group of voters, and I don't think this can be disputed, who voted for him because they trusted his judgment, and they voted for him to represent him as their agent and to do what he thought was in his best judgment, was best for the interests of the 9th Senatorial District.
What's the compelling state interest in that argument if it circumvents the mandate of the people?
Well, those voters would be treated differently under their reading of the statute. If Daniel Hall switched parties and we required the party affiliation to be determined at the time of the election, that group of voters, however small they might be, would be treated differently.
There's a compelling state interest to interpret the statute our way, because interpreting the statute our way goes with the will of the majority of the voters. And that's what Rodriguez talks about. That is the compelling state interest. Interpreting the statute in favor of this minority group who voted just to trust Daniel Hall there's no compelling state interest in that when you are going against the will of the voters and the mandate of the voters. You know, I think it's important to point out that, you know, we can speculate why Daniel Hall got elected, but we do know the one time he ran as a Republican, he lost.
What's your point?
That the voters elected a Democrat. Daniel Hall was a Democrat. They elected a Democrat to a 4-year term. That is the only concrete knowledge we know of what the will of the voters was. And he had that First Amendment right to switch, and he could have vindicated his decision this November had he chose to, but he didn't. I mean, that's the answer to this. If you think you're the right way, the voters will let you know in November.
Before the hearing on the Senate floor this morning, Senate Minority Leader Jeff Kessler stood to address the historic nature of the Supreme Court's proceedings today.
When our former colleague from the Senator from Wyoming switched parties, there was probably nobody in this chamber more adversely affected by that decision than me. But the day I walked out here, Mr. President, and you grabbed that gavel, I called you Mr. President. Today, I don't know how the court's going to rule. We don't know how the court's going to rule. But I would hope that at the end of the day, that whoever is seated and appointed by the governor as providing our Constitution to that seat, and guided by the highest court in the state of West Virginia concerning interpretations of statute and the Constitution of this state, that we will give that person, be it a D or be it a R, the same deference, the same courtesy, and the same respect that we gave the senator from Roane
when he walked on this floor just last Wednesday. So with that, Mr. President, because the work that we have in front of us is greater than that between the division between the parties and the party lines, the work we have for the people of this state, the people who have elected all of us, who have divided us evenly, is the most important work that we can do, Mr. President.
Even though members of the West Virginia Senate are largely focused on who will fill that vacant seat in the chamber, they haven't slowed on a controversial proposal that will likely see a vote by the end of the week. That measure is right to work, a law that dozens of other states have enacted. But as Rob Engel reports, the verdict is still out on whether the measure is right for West Virginia.
The 2016 legislative session, hundreds of union workers packed the upper rotunda to make their position clear on this controversial bill. But with such intense debate about the impact of a right-to-work law on West Virginia, this legislation is anything but black and white. Officially known as the West Virginia Workplace Freedom Act, it would mean any new employment contract or contract that is modified, renewed, or extended as of July 1st, 2016 could not require an employee to become or remain a member of a labor union, require the payment of union dues, nor require the payment of those dues to a third party. The act also nullifies existing agreements that contain these types of employee requirements. Currently, the country is just as divided on the issue of right to work as West Virginia. 25 states have these laws, while 25 do not. Opponents say they have seen the effects on unions in other states and worry what will happen if West Virginia becomes state number 26 to pass the legislation. Kenny Perdue is the president of the West Virginia AFL-CIO, one of the state's largest unions.
Right to work has one principle. That's why it was created in the early 1920s, was to eliminate the power of a union workforce.
This is Dave Martin, president of Local 566 Steelworkers in Ravenswood.
My concern is if our legislature passes a right to work law, what it's going to do to my union and my members. It's going to kill our union.
Martin explains today non-union workers in union workplaces still pay a certain fee to the unions for their representation in contract negotiations. But if West Virginia becomes a right-to-work state, the union would no longer be able to collect these fees. Martin, along with many other union members, says right-to-work simply gives non-union workers the license to be free riders, to benefit from the collective bargaining of a union without being a member or paying for it.
If a person decides to drop out of the union, we are still legally required to represent them, even though they pay us no dues. If you could opt out of paying taxes but still get all the same benefits from all the government functions of everything, then why wouldn't you too?
But supporters of right to work, such as Brian Hoyleman, see these effects in a much different light.
This law does one very important thing, and that is it prohibits organizations in the state of West Virginia, union or otherwise, from requiring its members or employees from having to pay dues, fees, or assessments as a condition of employment. So basically, what that means is currently in West Virginia, if you belong to an organized labor union and you're not happy with their services, you cannot pull yourself out of that union and stop paying them dues for those services, or you could lose your job. So this law would prohibit that. And of course, our position is one that is very much in favor of this law because it provides workers the freedom to make those decisions for themselves.
Still, union workers argue the impact of weighing individual worker freedoms over the protection of the group.
I worked for a large corporation for half my life, and they let me go after 13 years. So I had to start over. And when I started over, I chose something that I thought no one could take away from me, which was a trade.
Tara Turley is an electrician, member of the Electrical Workers 466, but most importantly, she says, a mother. Like many laborers, Turley feels that this legislation will have a negative impact on her wages, as some studies have shown in other states.
I put on my boots every day and I go out in cold weather and I don't get paid days off or any of that. And I work real hard and I've started over trying to do that, to take care of my girls. So I have two daughters.
Like Turley, Matt Harper with the Laborers Local 1353 also worries about his wages being affected by the bill. Harper is working on the renovations of Building 3 on the Capitol Complex in Charleston.
Oh, I love my job. I love what I do. The people I work with, the company I work for, you don't know what you're going to do from day to day. You don't know what job you're going to be on from day to day. It's versatile. I mean, you can come into work. You just don't know what you're going to do, and it's what I like about it. I wouldn't want to do nothing else but what I do. Right to work is wrong for the state of West Virginia because it does nothing but hurt the working person. It's not going to bring no other jobs here. It's not going to bring nothing of any significant value to this state.
Union workers worry that a right to work bill will not only decrease wages, but also make the work environment less safe, as non-union workers aren't as well trained. And a final decision on this bill will come just a few hundred yards away from Matt Harper's work site.
But supporters say there is significant value to right to work in West Virginia, that it is the first piece in a larger puzzle to build a better economic climate. Hoylman says while right to work is not a silver bullet, it is an important initial step in attracting new industry.
When you have a situation where businesses are looking for new places to expand, they won't go unless you can check that box about right to work. Then they'll get into those other things, regulatory reform, tax reform. So if you get all of those things and you get them in a place where they're positive, then we can really spur some growth. But you can't just do one thing.
There have been studies that show it is unclear what the true impact of right to work is for West Virginia. Studies across the country have shown both positive and negative effects to implementing right to work laws, and the same can be said for West Virginia. There's no real definitive answer yet if the bill will help or hurt the state. For the legislature today, I'm Rob Engel at the Capitol.
The Senate's Right to Work bill has already made its way through its major committee reference and had its first reading on the floor today. Senator Charles Trump's Judiciary Committee spent 3 days discussing the proposed right to work law last week. Committee members heard from union representatives, former union workers from out of state opposed to the bill, and even members of Governor Tomlin's cabinet like Commerce Secretary Keith Burdett. Minimal changes were made to the proposed bill, which had its first reading on the floor on Tuesday. Senator Trump says he knows the issue is a divisive one, but says he believes approving the bill is the right thing to do for West Virginia.
This state has, unfortunately, the lowest labor force participation rate in the entire country. West Virginia, the state we love, is the only state in the United States that has lost population since 1950. Every other state has more people living in it than lived in it in 1950, except West Virginia. We have to take measures to turn the tide and grow some prosperity in West Virginia. And this is one of those measures.
The Senate will vote on Senate Bill 1, the West Virginia Workplace Freedom Act, Thursday. Lawmakers, of course, travel from across the state to the Capitol each year to represent their districts during the legislative session. Here's a look at some of those representatives from the Northern Panhandle.
Jack Yost is a Democrat from Brook County. He was elected to the West Virginia Senate in 2008 to represent the 1st District. Before Republicans took over the majority in the Senate in 2015, Yost served as the chair of the Senate's Labor Committee. Senator Yost served as a member of the House of Delegates from 2002 to 2006 and is a former member of the Wellsburg City Council. Outside of politics, Yost serves as the Sovereign Grand Inspector General of the Scottish Rite Orient of West Virginia, a Masonic service organization. Ryan Weld is a Republican serving West Virginia's 2nd House of Delegates District. Elected in 2014, Weld hails from Brook County. Delegate Weld is a member of the House Judiciary and Veterans Affairs Committees. He also served as chairman of the Wellsburg Urban Redevelopment Authority. Delegate Weld has an 18-year-old Chihuahua Terrier mix named Winston, who he says he missed more than anyone when he was abroad serving in Afghanistan. Sean Fluharty was elected to represent the House of Delegates 3rd District in 2014. A Democrat from Ohio County, he serves as the Minority Vice Chair of the Industry and Labor Committee. Delegate Fluharty previously served as a commissioner on the Wheeling Human Rights Commission. He's left-handed and owns a pug named Dexter. Erica Storch was first elected to the House of Delegates in 2010. A Republican, she represents the 3rd Delegate District from Ohio County. Delegate Storch chairs the House Interstate Cooperation and Political Subdivision Committees. Storch is also the president of the Wheeling Area Chamber of Commerce. Delegate Storch is a proud mother of 3 who enjoys being active. She says her first job was delivering pizzas and later became a flight attendant.
To say state lawmakers are facing yet another tight budget year is becoming a bit of a cliche in West Virginia. But for the state's higher education system, those cuts are becoming harder and harder to bear. Liz McCormick has more.
For years, higher education in West Virginia has endured budget reductions from the state legislature. Some representatives from the state's public universities have voiced concern that lawmakers aren't taking the cuts and their impacts on the system seriously. And with a proposed $14 million cut by Governor Tomlin again this year, they're not feeling much better. Concord University President Kendra Bodges says the continual cuts make it difficult to keep West Virginia's schools competitive because they often result in the cutting of classes or student activities.
It's very difficult to continue to not cut programs, to not cut people, to save jobs when the funding is going away. We are pretty bare bones, and I think most of the small schools in the state are at that place. I think even the larger schools are at that place where it's very difficult to balance your budget.
Lawmakers have consistently stated that higher education is important to the state to have a successful workforce and to improve population growth. So why do these budget cuts keep happening year after year? Bodges argues it has to do with the way the state code is written.
We are not one of those budgetary areas that can go without being cut. I mean, there are certain things like public education, K-12. In the code, it mandates a certain amount be spent on schools of those schools. But we're not in that. And so we are one of the areas that can be cut when there are an inadequate budget, when the budget hasn't been met.
As a response to the budget cuts, many universities and colleges in the state have increased tuition costs. But this hurts them too. Bodges says it could result in losing potential students or force students who can't afford the tuition hikes not to return to school. The West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy said in a May 2015 report, tuition at West Virginia schools has increased by 32% since the 2007-2008 school year. Ted Bettner is the center's executive director.
Since 2013, we've cut $62 million from higher education, and that's without adjusting for inflation. If you do that, it's well over $75 million. So what this means is it makes it more difficult for especially low and moderate income students to go to college because it gets out of reach. That's because they have to increase tuition. When you don't fund higher education, they increase tuition. It makes it much more difficult to build a strong economy with a well-educated workforce, which in West Virginia, that's what we should be doing. We have the lowest share of people with a bachelor's degree or higher, and we need to be doing the opposite.
Bettner believes one way to help to increase the budget for higher education is by closing tax loopholes.
If you go get your hair cut today, you're not going to pay a sales tax at the barber. But if you, buy a book at the bookstore, you're going to pay sales tax. So I think we have to make sure that we're treating everybody fairly. And we also, when we look at tax increases, that we don't just think about taxing low and moderate income families, but that we also point to the people who've got the most out of economic growth over the last 30 years. And those are the people in the top 1%, top 5%. And I think we need to ensure that they're paying an adequate share.
Despite the proposed $14 million budget cut to public universities and colleges this year, lawmakers are confident they can find a way to help the system. Lawmakers on the House Finance Committee are planning to look closely at legislation that could help improve the budget for higher education institutions. But many say it's still too early to say what specifically they'll propose. Delegate Eric Nelson of Kanawha County is the House Finance Chairman.
To balance this budget, I mean, there's revenue measures, there's cuts. Can we move other funds around? We're going to look at anything. And we've got some very needy colleges that are really producing in certain areas of the state that have been underfunded the last 3-4 years. Up in the Eastern Panhandle, when you talk about Blue Ridge Community College and Shepherd, and we can just go right across the board. So we'll look at various options and also ask the universities how they can be creative.
Nelson adds, in a tight budget year, his committee will be looking for creative solutions to fund more than just higher education. For the Legislature Today, I'm Liz McCormick in the House.
Tomorrow on our show, House Speaker Tim Armstead joins us to discuss his legislative priorities for this session. This has been the Legislature Today. I'm Ashton Mara. Thanks for joining us.
Support for the Legislature Today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually in our state by 2025. Through increased opportunities for West Virginians to earn the credentials today's economy demands. The High Technology Foundation, building a stronger West Virginia, online at wvhtf.org. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.